May it please the court, I am still Brad Holbrook, and I am still representing Brenda Benjamin, the personal representative in these consolidated cases, along with Mr. Norton. These cases are ancillary to the case we just argued about. There's two entities, Sixth Street Development LLC, which I'll call Development, and Sixth Street Rentals, which I will call Rentals. Development owned commercial as well as commercial real estate, which BD used to operate its construction business, along with storage units. Rentals owned construction trailers and a Polaris Ranger that was also rented by BD for its construction business. At Mr. Benjamin's passing, he owned a third interest in Development and a half interest in Rentals. Another entity that was ancillary to these parties, but not to the BD business, was Kearney Drive and Storage. That also came into play in this case because Development owned 25% of that, Mr. Benjamin owned 65%, and Great Western Properties owned 10%. The reason that we're here today and the issues that we've raised on appeal is that it is absolutely a fact, the court has found, that Mr. Bierman, after he unilaterally elected himself as manager of both Development and Rentals, breached the operating agreement when he provided notice of intention to continue the business after the death of Mr. Benjamin, elected to purchase that interest, elected Mr. Galloway to set that value, and then refused to close on it because for lots of reasons, one of which is that we just got done talking about the BD case, and Mr. Fobot was talking about the breach of fiduciary duty by Mrs. Benjamin because she refused to close on an agreement with BD. This case proved, and the court found, that wasn't the case. Mr. Bierman backed out of all of them. Exhibit 153 was a March 31st, 2016 email that said, hey, if we're going to have to close on Development Rentals, then we're going to rethink BD price. So I want to make sure that we get that clear because obviously that wasn't in the other case, but it is in this case. Ultimately, this case is a lot different than BD, even though we have a buy-sell agreement in it. We have an operating agreement for both Development and Rentals. It's identical. It says if somebody dies, we dissolve unless continued. If continued, you don't have to elect to buy, but you can. If you do elect to buy, we have to agree on what the price is. We got 90 days to do that. If we don't, then we select a mutually agreed upon appraiser, and he or she sets fair market value, plain and simple. And that's what happened in this case. The parties agreed on Mr. Galloway, who was unbeknownst or had no connections to either party, to do that valuation, and he did it. He was done by about November 15, but waiting on the Staley appraisals. Those were done March 7th and 8th of 2016. He hands out reports, says, here you go, this is what it's all worth. There was an error of a double counting of March building and a four-year toys that hadn't been appraised. Not a problem. We get those appraised. The difference in that double count of March building and the four-year toys was about $8,000. He provides oral updates of, here you go, I'm done, here's the price, this is what Development and Rentals owes the estate to buy out Mr. Benjamin's interest. Mr. Bierman doesn't want to close. He doesn't want to close because he wasn't sure if he was going to end up with BD. He wasn't sure about the life insurance. He wanted the court to rule on that. He was upset about the value of Kearney Drive-In Storage and how it impacted the value of Development. He didn't like the life insurance being in there. He didn't have the funds to close. There's all kinds of reasons he gave as to why he didn't close. We get to trial. All of those things have been resolved, whether life insurance should or shouldn't be in, whether we agreed with it or not. We had a ruling. The value of Kearney Drive-In Storage, that was done. That was a separate lawsuit that had been settled, so we have that value. And he's still all the way up in the trial, never offered to close. And the trial court correctly found, you've breached the agreement. We don't have to sell. Here's the problem, though. This LLC continues because they elected to continue it, but they also elected to buy us out, and then they breached that agreement. Now we're stuck in business with the individual that who's controlling the business.
What's the standard that you have to show to dissolve? Is it statutory?
Well, the statute, I don't recall 21-2095, I'm sorry, wrong statute, 21-147 providing a standard of what you must prove. So, and I'm not aware of...
The statute says something, doesn't it?
Well, it says what the statute says, if it's no longer reasonably practical to stay in business together, it should be dissolved. And if somebody that's in control has acted oppressively and detrimentally harmful to the other members, it should dissolve.
So
it doesn't say what
might. Which hook are you?
Both.
Both,
because they both exist. It's no longer reasonably practical that the case is rife with Mr. Bierman calling Mark Benjamin a liar, a thief, saying the same thing about Mrs. Benjamin, saying Mark Benjamin owed.
Does that make it not reasonably practical?
Absolutely, it's not reasonably practical. Both parties said, I don't trust the other party. I don't want to be in business with the other party. They both said, I don't want to be in business together. When specifically asked the question, what are we going to do about it, if you don't want to be in business together and you can't communicate except through counsel, Mr. Bierman's response is, well, we can run it through counsel. I'm not sure that's a very viable option, to run a business through counsel. That's not reasonably practical to call me every day, 15 times a day, to deal with business issues. And I can't imagine anybody wanting to run a business that way. In addition to that, not only is it reasonably practical, but the oppressive conduct. Mr. Bierman, after he backs out of BD and refuses to close under Mr. Galloway's values, locks the estate out of Mark's building, requires their keys to be returned, takes over all the finances, fires BD that was finishing out Mark's building, hires his own related entity, Scotty's Property, to finish it out around $300,000, and then rents it to Bierman Contracting, Inc. for $200 a month. Bierman Contracting, Inc. is where Mr. Hoppenstedt and Mr. Bierman now are employed, 100 yards away from BD, competing directly against BD. That's what he does. He doesn't provide any accounting, doesn't provide any information. He files lawsuits on this Kearney Drive-In Storage lawsuit. Mr. Galloway valued it at $761,000, and he sues the estate and Mrs. Benjamin individually. She's not even a party to this, for $1.56 million. Everything he did was designed to apply pressure to her to get the BD case to go away. But she wasn't going to go away. We get to trial, and the court specifically mentions, yeah, this isn't a good situation, but it's not such to the level that I think that I can dissolve it, because that's such an extreme remedy. What other remedy do the parties have? Mr. Bierman,
that's what the law says, isn't it? That it's an extreme remedy?
It is an extreme remedy. And I don't think that every time partners get into fights that the entity should be dissolved. The problem we have in this case is the only way for the estate to get out was to be bought out. Mr. Bierman made that election. Mr. Bierman agreed to use Terry Galloway. Mr. Bierman had the valuation. Mr. Bierman, for reasons everything other than what had to do with development and rentals, said, I'm out. I'm not going to close with you. So I'm not sure what other option, even though it is an extreme remedy, it's all of his actions that have us still in bed together. And for him to be able to profit off of that and say, no, don't dissolve us. And it is, by the way, telling in their brief what they suggested to do is, well, under the Business Model Business Corporation Act, if somebody brings an action for dissolution, the remaining individuals can elect to buy you out. That doesn't exist in the LLC statutes. It does in the Business Corporation Act, but not in the LLC statutes. It would be another bite of the apple for him, but even on appeal, he's trying to figure out a way to get her out. I don't know why we just don't dissolve this thing. Nobody wants to be in business together. We ought to go that way. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, if I may.
Thank you. You may. Thank you very much. Mr. Swoboda, good morning again.
Good morning again. It's an unusual situation, but a couple things that I want to address. And first and foremost, when Mr. Galloway was selected as the independent appraiser, our clients didn't give up the right to have a fair market value determination. That's what the operating agreements required, and that's what we demanded. The problem was Mr. Galloway never prepared a fair market value assessment. And I have to go and talk a little bit about that Frederick Peebles, Morgan, and Assam case that you all decided about 2 years ago. And Mr. Galloway made the very same mistakes in this case that the defendant's expert made in that case. He quoted Revenue Ruling 5960 in his report, but he didn't utilize it because Revenue Ruling 5960, which is right in his report, says it's got to be between a hypothetical buyer and a hypothetical seller. He contradicts himself in that report when he later says...
So is your quarrel with Mr. Galloway that he was not impartial or that he simply botched the valuation?
I don't know if it was intentional or not, but he was an advocate for Mrs. Benjamin, and he took every opportunity to increase the value so that she could get more in her pocket.
If that is your argument, when was his valuation completed?
Right.
That
this is important.
After he becomes her advisor?
Okay. Very good question, very important. His report's dated November 30, 2015, but it's not done that date, okay? What he utilized in his report primarily was Roderick Staley's appraisals. Roderick Staley's letter to him is dated February 24, 2016. Okay? 2 months essentially after the date of Galloway's report. And he says in his letter, the date of the inspection, meaning Staley's inspection, was February 15, 2016. So how could Galloway's report be done on November 30? It wasn't. Our clients didn't get the initial version of the report until March 9, 2016. And then, Mr. Holbrook told you, there were problems with it. Our clients pointed out the fact that one of the properties wasn't even included in his report. And another property was included twice. So there were all kinds of problems with that report. And then that's about the time you get into the BD negotiations, and Mrs. Benjamin made the requirement that we have to agree on all or we're going to agree on none. Well, we had the life insurance, $1,750,000 in the valuation of 6th Street. She would not negotiate off of that point. The court had to decide that issue, and the court decided that doesn't get included in here because the insurance was purchased to fund the buyout on the date of death.
Is there any way to de-link these two pieces of litigation?
There's different parties, and I will say that. It's not the same parties. In this case, on 6th Street Development, you have Doug Bierman, Gene Bierman, and Mr. Benjamin. On 6th Street Rentals, it's just Doug Bierman and Mark Benjamin.
And then further, I wasn't clear in my question, the case that was previously argued that you all are calling the BD case.
Right? Yeah, there's a different party in that as well.
Okay. So are they inextricably linked in outcome?
No. No.
So and this one, we're LLCs, our form of business is LLCs, right?
Right. And we have an operating agreement that says on
the
death.
But in the quote BD case, corporate form of business.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Does it matter?
Yes, it does, because upon Mr. Benjamin's death, Mrs. Benjamin is treated as a dissociated member. And as such, she's entitled to an accounting, which they asked for and then waived right before they filed their appeal. She does not have the right as a dissociated member to seek dissolution. And we raised that in a motion that we filed after the appeal was filed. We filed a motion that she didn't have standing to seek dissolution as a dissociated member. Okay? And so...
What's the status of that motion that you filed after the appeal?
We were hoping we'd hear something from you before today's date. In other words, we filed our motion when it was still in the Court of Appeals, and that came up to you at all. We have not received a ruling on that.
Are you done in the trial level?
The motion was filed at the appellate level.
Oh, I didn't understand that.
Excuse me. Yeah.
me too, I beg your pardon.
So I want to also talk about one of the provisions in the operating agreements on both of these. There's a 120-day period following the determination of fair market value where the parties have to close. After 120 days, interest can accrue. Okay? The trial court here started interest on November 30. Okay? We've already told you the values weren't determined as of that date. And even when he came out with his first version of the report in March, that version later changed, and the new one was put out in February of 2018. But it still had the life insurance, okay? And the only way we were going to make a determination as to whether or not insurance should or shouldn't be included was to present it to the court. So it's our belief that the 120 days never began to run prior to trial because we couldn't get the insurance, life insurance, excluded from the negotiations. And the district court determined that it should be, yet it went back and assessed interest at a time when the report wasn't available.
Is the fair market value to be established by the independent appraiser or by the court?
It's to be established by the independent appraiser, if there was one in this case. We submit that at some point, he was not the independent appraiser.
If we find otherwise, can we second guess the independent appraiser's determination? I mean, you're relying on the Fredericks case saying Mr. Galloway did things wrong, but assuming he is independent, can we second guess that?
One of the things that he didn't do is apply a control and marketability discount. I think if you took his number and applied that, because he says you got to do that, he said to Mrs. Benjamin in the BD case, you got to apply a 35% discount to our client's shares when they were fired. He knows how to do it. He just didn't do it here. Mr. Benjamin only had a one-third interest in development.
But what's the purpose of having an independent third-party appraiser if you're going to ask the court to ultimately determine fair market value?
I think that goes to his independence. Okay? And that's a good question, and that's the answer to it.
Does it have to do with his method or independence or both?
Well, I think one of the things you have to remember is that at trial it was determined that Mr. Galloway had under management assets of Mrs. Benjamin. And so the more he got under his control, the more he earned. There was a question.
So if he had been truly independent, as you're suggesting he's not, and you still disagreed with his valuation, the method, the control marketability discount, things of that nature, the including or not including certain properties, would you have had the ability to contest that valuation?
If he didn't apply a discount, we believe that he needed to do that. And that's all that really needs to be done to his value.
So really, he wouldn't make the final determination. You still have a right to contest that and the court to make that final determination based on
yes,
their authority.
We believe that he understood his charge to be one to prepare fair market value, and he didn't do that because he didn't apply the principles that you all announced in the Assam case, particularly the discounts.
Do I understand you to have said that the valuations are okay here except he has not put in a discount for minority ownership?
I think that's the quick fix. Yeah, yeah. That also takes care of the damage issue. The district court came up with some damage calculation, which was completely foreign to the parties. He took our expert's valuation of fair market value, which he found our expert to be more credible, and then he took Galloway's, subtracted off the insurance, and then subtracted ours. He took two values, subtracted the smaller one from the greater one, and came up with a damage figure, which there's no support for that in the law or the facts. There was no evidence that there was any diminution in value of the interest of Mr. Benjamin from the date of his death until trial. It's just the most contrived damage calculation I've ever seen. We didn't quite understand it and still don't. So unless there's further questions, I see my time has run.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, 1 minute and 10 seconds.
1 minute and 10 seconds. Mr. Holbrook.
Thank you, Your Honor. In discussing the issue of fair market value, the appellees take the position that it has to be some type of specific definition that we all agree upon. That's not the case. The operating agreement specifically set how you determine price. The mutually agreed appraiser will determine fair market value, however he or she sees fit, however he or she, whatever methodology he or she uses, whatever assets or debts he or she includes or excludes.
So that, life insurance, that leads to my question. If he's completely independent and he makes an error in valuation, simple, include property, not include property, and but it goes all the way to the parties and they cannot agree because of that, what happens to that valuation? Does the court get to decide it at that point, or is it just the valuation, everybody's stuck with that valuation even though they know that it leaves something out or adds something in?
Yeah. Well, and that's at least the $1.75 million question. Obviously, there's no guidance in the operating agreement. I think the reality of the situation are that parties then try to negotiate. In this case, we attempted to. They weren't going anywhere. They said, we're out on everything.
You're not suggesting that an independent appraiser who wholly abdicates his appraisal function uses a Ouija board, that's enforceable?
Well, the agreement is enforceable. Reliance upon the report, that's when you have a problem. But the disagreements that the appellees had with his report weren't the math. It was, you put insurance in, we don't think it should be out. Their expert was told, kick it out. Neither of their experts said, I excluded it for business valuation purposes. Mr. Galloway testified, just like in the prior case, I included it because that's what you do. That's what you do when you're performing a valuation. It is an asset of the estate. It was a cash asset converted into a premium, now into a non-operating asset, and it has value. And according to the rules that I follow, I include it. So if we do have a Ouija board appraisal, I can understand where a party would have a hard time enforcing that in a court, as opposed to somebody saying, this is the methodologies and why I did what I did. None of you gave me any instructions. You had the opportunity to do so. This is what I did, why I did. That is enforceable. And in the court, in this case,
the court shows one expert valuation over the other. Is that correct?
That happened. In this case, there was no valuation in terms of picking one over the other. The court found Terry Galloway was the independent appraiser. That's the number. So it wasn't a picking, but the reason I mention that issue is because we're talking about the life insurance. The only evidence was that it should be included according to professional standards of valuing businesses. And that's the reason they wouldn't close, is we wanted it out.
So your view is, regardless of how Mr. Galloway feels about the parties, he employed a generally accepted accounting method?
Yes. Absolutely. I see I'm again way over time. Thank you so much, unless there's any further questions.
Thank you very much. That takes us then to the next case of the day, which is Schaefer Shapiro versus Ball.